welcome to Dialect Radio from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 FM and Radio Verulam in St Albans, and to our listeners in Swindon. Hello, Swindon FM.
What we didn't remember was that in Beira they speak Portuguese and we speak English. So the early days were quite interesting, just trying to communicate with each other.
Our theme for this week's show is town twinning. Bristol is linked to seven towns worldwide, from Tbilisi in Georgia to Hanover in Germany.
We had this lovely big pink wobbly blancmange, and there was the belly dancer with all her wobbly bits, and it was really fun.
With last week's Jubilee celebrations, retro food is back in fashion. You can hear more about that later on in the show.
A bit like Golden Compass, a bit like as if Tim Burton had done Harry Potter.
And yes, an exciting new film is presently being shot in the West Country. We meet the producer. Malcolm reads another instalment of Lady Stanhope's Travels. Jeff Sparks couldn't be with us this week, but he has written us a What's On guide. I'm Ian Hodgkinson.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. I'd like to introduce Darren Jones to the studio. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
You are a lawyer, but you're also a school governor.
I am, that's right. No, I'm a trainee solicitor at one of our local firms here in Bristol called Bond Pierce, but I'm a local authority governor of Hallamore Primary School in the south of Bristol, and was previously chair of governors for Avon Primary in the north of Bristol.
Okay, so what led you to taking those roles? Was that an interest in education particularly?
Very much so. The first role I had, which was at Avon Primary School, was sentimental because it was my former primary school.
Okay, fair enough.
And being originally from Lawrence Weston, I understood some of the issues in terms of educational attainment and aspiration and opportunity, and having had the opportunity to go to university and, you know, enter the professions and come back to Bristol, I felt it would be a good opportunity to use the skills that I'd learned in order to try and continue to make a difference there, as they did with me when I was there.
Right. What was your experience of education, you know, when you were actually in school? Was it noticeable then, particularly to you, about the inequality in education?
Not whilst I was there. I think it only occurs to you once you leave and enter a competitive market in terms of higher education and certainly employment. But certainly at the moment, my firm, who have a strong focus on our corporate social responsibility, we have been working with a charity called Ablaze at the moment. And actually, we've gone back to my secondary school, which used to be Portway Community School in North Bristol, is now Oasis Academy Brightstow, in order to do sessions with Year 9 pupils, so aged kind of 13, 14.
Okay, just before you're there doing their GCSEs.
That's correct, yeah. So we're just talking to them now about the opportunity that are available to them and how they might want to aspire to them. And as I said just now, I think that you don't really recognise the inequality until you go back to see it. So it wasn't that long ago that I was at Portway School.
How did that make you feel then, your first impression of inequality?
I don't want to say hard done by, but it made me angry in a positive way. I kind of saw the impact of that inequality and saw the injustice in it. And as a consequence, I wanted to try and do something to change that, if I could, or at least contribute to changing
it. So describe what that inequality really means.
It's about choices. And, you know, what we need to be clear with is that some people will go back to particular types of schools, or they'll think about these types of decisions, and they'll almost patronise the kids in a way. There's nothing wrong with deciding you want to work in, you know, Asda or in retail or settle down and have a family. That's absolutely fine if you've made the active choice to do it. Yeah. If you've not had the opportunity to consider anything else, that's where the injustice lies.
Okay, so what's stopping people being able to make a choice?
Knowing about it, I think, is the first and foremost point. And actually, that's the most easiest because you can tell them. So that's why I'm really pleased to be going back to my old secondary school, to be able to show people that if you work hard, you can do things like be a lawyer.
Does that not infer that teachers are sort of institutionalised into essentially processing kids like a factory and just not telling them?
Perhaps. I think schools are doing better than they used to be. Certainly, you know, as a Labour Party person and as a former parliamentary candidate, I've seen through the evidence of our policy outcomes that perhaps we over-legislated in terms of focusing purely on outcomes and not progress within the academic sense.
Okay,
and not
that's
the
interesting.
Wider
so
sense.
When did you first stand for a candidacy? What was your history with the Labour Party?
Well, I was always political in the apolitical sense, so I was always shouting at various people to try and get things changed. But I didn't become party political until I went to university, and the Labour Party was a very natural home for me because it shares the same values that I do. I kind of campaigned, ran for some local elections in Plymouth when I was at university, and then stood as the parliamentary candidate for Torridge and West Devon in 2010. And now, you know, obviously, I'm here in Bristol practicing law, but I'm also still involved with the Labour Party here as well.
Okay, so what do you think about what the Conservative, you know, people maybe already be putting the words together about what you're going to say, but I mean, obviously the austerity that we're facing, not only making people thinking it's going to be a lot harder to be able to fund education, but also possibly annoyed at the Labour Party.
Yeah, I think that there were things that we did wrong that we need to be able to accept and arguably apologise for. So there's no doubt that since, I think, around 2004-05, we did start to borrow more than we were getting into the Exchequer in order to fund certain projects. And we needed to start thinking around that time about how sustainable those boom years were. What I disagree with is the argument to say that we shouldn't have done what we did at the start of the financial crash in 2008. You know, people need to recognise that if we didn't do that, you would have gone to the cash point, there would have been no money. We had to save the economy by borrowing internationally to invest in the banks. And if we didn't, we would have been in a depression.
Okay, well, that's a good point. But let's come back to the education. You said that the first thing that you think makes the inequality is knowledge. Let's talk about more of the financial aspects, particularly given austerity. What things are going to stop people being able to get ahead in education because of cuts?
I think what's really important is the first 4 years of a child's life, equally primary and secondary education, but those first 4 years can have a significant impact in outcomes when you're over 18. And I saw that as chair of governors at Avon Primary School back in Shirehampton, because we would have pupils coming in reception who were already significantly behind the average in terms of key skills. And so they perhaps weren't able to write numbers or their name or whatever. And so the school would have to invest significant amounts of money and time to bring them up to the average in year six. And as I said at the very beginning, when you then enter a wider competitive market, when you leave school, suddenly you're far behind the line because of those first 4 years of failure.
What about education after you've left school? In particular, Open University have just put up their fees in England because of the austerity cuts. So it's now a lot harder to be able to pay your way. It's now going to cost you about £15,000 to do the equivalent of a three-year degree. I mean, what do you think about education after school?
I think continuing education is really important because we can always learn new things and we always need new skills. And certainly our economy now, although I do think we need an industrial policy in terms of things like manufacturing, but it's right to say there's a strong focus in our economy on skills and service-based professions. And to do that, you do need some further and higher education level skills. And so continuing education is important right through from the age of 18 all the way through, I think.
So let's try and inject a bit of positivity, because the cuts sort of infer that with the lack of investment, giving people more equality in education is going to be harder. Can anybody do about it?
I would hope that the idea of localism and working together as communities would mean that should you give sufficient resources and support to communities, actually we can start to raise standards by ourselves. But the cynic in me would say that that only works in areas where you already have those skills and resources, i.e. the middle-class communities, and not necessarily in the working-class communities. And actually, the localism agenda being driven by the current Conservative-led government will actually increase inequality, not decrease it.
OK, so what are you thinking about doing as a school governor?
Well, there's lots to do. Hannamore is a very interesting primary school. It's a very diverse primary school. Some very different challenges. So when I was at Avon Primary, it was 99% white British, so there was a lack of understanding of diversity. At Hannamore, I think it's 75% Somali, so you've got some language issues in terms of the English language, but also cultural and diversity challenges that we need to be able to face as well, and that's all linked to attainment, so lots to do.
Okay, so in some ways the equality may be more clear-cut in the school that you're governing at the moment because of the obvious racial divide between them being Somalis and trying to incorporate themselves into British life.
Different inequalities, absolutely. So back in Avon Primary, it was a question about access and aspiration and understanding the opportunities that were available to you. In Hannamore, we have the questions about also understanding those questions, but within a British context of a population of pupils that are very transient and will, percentage of them that will leave Bristol during their education. And so that's a particular challenge for our teaching staff about how you maintain educational provision for pupils that are coming and going.
Interesting. Okay, and what in terms of hard facts do you really hope you're going to be able to achieve, I don't know, say in the next sort of 5 years?
I think the focus has to be on the delivery of education that is right for all of our pupils, and that's about making sure that our lesson planning, our teachers and our resources are focused not just on children who are gifted and talented at one end or special educational needs at the other end, but making sure we deliver a programme that is right and inclusive for the whole of the school to be able to provide that equal opportunity.
Darren Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Our next feature, Steve Strong, speaks about the early days of the Bristol Beira Link, when he and a few others travelled to Mozambique in the last stages of its brutal civil war to set up a cultural link with Bristol. The songs are sung by children from Clifton High School, a school which has links with a school in Beira.
Mm-hmm. My name is Susie Weldon and I'm a freelance journalist, and I was asked to write this book on the link between Bristol and Beira. And I have to admit, I had heard of Beira, but I really didn't know very much about it. So it was a fascinating experience to delve into the history, not just of Beira, but Mozambique, to learn why Beira is such an important city in Mozambique. It's a port city, brought in a great deal of trade into not just Mozambique, but the rest of Africa. But then to learn of the very, very troubled history of the last 100 years in particular, with the oppression in the first half of the last century from the colonial authorities and the struggle for independence, and then the absolutely vicious so-called civil war. It wasn't really a civil war, but it was a war funded and encouraged and perpetrated really by South Africa and Rhodesia as it was then, as part of the struggle against the anti-apartheid campaigners and the independence campaigners of Southern Africa. So to read all that and read how much the people of Mozambique suffered, and then to read how this small group of committed anti-apartheid campaigners in Bristol, which was then the biggest anti-apartheid region in the UK, how they decided that they would try and establish a sense of solidarity and work with the people of Beira, and how they set up this tiny charity while the war was still going on, just in the last years of the war, and how they've worked together. It's been tremendously inspiring. So I feel very proud to have been part of documenting what they've done. But obviously the real credit goes to all the people who've tirelessly worked and fundraised and established links over the last 21 years. I think it's a real testimony to the people of Bristol and the people of Beira that this charity was not only set up, but has really done some fantastic work.
What was the biggest discovery you made out of the whole programme?
I think there were two, really. The first one was reading about the history of the last conflict, the so-called civil war between RENAMO and Frelimo guerrillas, between the RENAMO government, as it was, and Frelimo, the guerrilla movement that was funded by, first of all, Rhodesia and then South Africa, because I truly, truly hadn't appreciated the horrors of that war. I think in the rest of the world, we didn't hear as much about it as, say, we would now. You know, we're talking about the 1970s until the early 90s. There wasn't the focus on it. But when you read what happened, I mean, the United Nations declared RENAMO to have launched the greatest Holocaust against human beings since the Second World War. That gives you an idea of the scale of the devastation. So when you read what the people of Mozambique suffered, your heart goes out to them. So that was one thing that I learned. And then in terms of the work of the charity, I think the greatest discovery was just how effective this really solid people-to-people contact can be. So you're talking about projects. There are no middlemen. You know, it really is about establishing relationships between the people of Bristol and the people of Beira, and the work you can do on the ground. The work they've done with the women's group, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it, Amai Musanani, which does some fantastic work, particularly around looking after HIV and AIDS orphans, of which there are a great many. Just small amounts of funding can be used to fantastic effect, go an awful long way. And I think that's something we all have to remember, because sometimes it seems that the problems in this world are almost too big for an individual to handle. You know, what can I do? What good is my £10 here, my £5 there? But actually, small amounts of funding used in the right kind of way can really bring about solid improvements and benefits to people's lives. And I think we must never forget that. We all have the power to bring about positive change, even if it seems that what we're doing is making a small contribution.
Do you think the war was inevitable, though, as a result of the Portuguese withdrawal overnight, virtually?
Well, the Portuguese withdrawal overnight came after a period of unrest with the independence struggle, but they withdrew overnight mainly because there was a military coup that happened in Portugal, and overnight their policy changed. And then by moving out almost overnight and leaving nothing behind, the Portuguese did not even leave a trained doctor, a doctor they trained in Mozambique, behind. And it was an absolute disgrace when you look back on it. But I don't think that meant what war was inevitable. What made war inevitable was, if you look back to that time, 1970s, Cold War was still going on. There was still a real concern in the West about what people like Russia, China, Cuba were doing.
these people were obviously friends of the African independence movements, because let's face it, they didn't have many friends on the other side. I mean, it wasn't as if we in the UK and the United States were doing a great deal of practically to help them gain their independence. So I think Mozambique was sort of caught up in two things. One was concerns around the Cold War, but the second one was that Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, was just going through its own very bitter and difficult struggle for independence, and it was desperate to stop Mozambique from giving a haven, a safe haven, to its own independence campaigners. And then the same thing was happening with South Africa. You know, the ANC, South Africa was doing everything it possibly could to stop the ANC, and Mozambique did offer a safe haven to those independence campaigners. And so that was what made the war inevitable. It was because Rhodesia and South Africa basically funded and perpetrated and supplied with arms a movement to set out deliberately to destabilize Mozambique in order to prevent Mozambique from offering a safe haven to elements that they wanted to prevent having an influence in their own countries.
Can you just remind us what your book's called?
It's called Sun, Sea and Solidarity. And it's got a subhead celebrating 21 years of Bristol's link with Beira. And it's on sale for the very reasonable price of $5.99. And obviously all the money goes directly to Bristol Link with Beira Fund to help them do more fantastic work.
Strong.
Can you tell us about the early days of the Bristol Beira Link?
Older people listening might remember the excitement when Mandela, you know, came out of prison, and it was clear for a couple of years that apartheid in South Africa was coming to an end. And what most people don't realise is that apartheid really affected all the countries in Southern Africa, not just South Africa. So the Mozambican economy was pretty well ruined by the South Africans. And Mozambican people, particularly men, would come and work in South Africa for next to nothing for most of the year. And so the economy of Mozambique was shattered by that, as well as all the fighting that was going on. So we decided in the anti-apartheid movement that we wanted to do some solidarity work. And one of the things we would do is a twinning link. And we identified Beira in Mozambique as the second city of Mozambique for two main reasons. One is it's about the same size as Bristol. And the second is it is a major port in Mozambique, as Bristol has been in the UK. So we thought we'd have some common ground. What we didn't remember was that in Beira they speak Portuguese and we speak English. So the early days were quite interesting, just trying to communicate with each other. And the other dimension, which is important, is that in Bristol, being part of the anti-apartheid movement, we supported the organisation that was leading the liberation of Mozambique. And not everyone in Mozambique agreed that that was the leading organisation. And there was another organisation called RENAMO that we opposed quite strongly because they were supported by the old South African regime. And RENAMO's main base in the whole of Mozambique is in Beira, which is the city we chose. So politically, we were more sympathetic to Frelimo, which was the main national party. But RENAMO, who were the opposition that fought Frelimo during the Civil War, their headquarters, in effect, was in Beira, which was the twin city that we'd chosen. So the early months and years were about us finding out whether there are ways of working with people that we had political strong differences with. Soon after a civil war, which was brutal, many people died, many people were disabled by landmines. People might remember Princess Diana. She worked in Mozambique on trying to clear some of the landmines. It was a dreadful situation where landmines covered large parts of the country and so prevented things like proper farming going on for many years, as well as causing many injuries, loss of limbs. The early days were exciting in a way that there were a number of difficulties that we had to overcome, but also we found common ground with local people really quite quickly. And the more we were able to concentrate on local people, local organisations, rather than the politics, the more we found things that we could be usefully doing.
So you've been involved with a lot of the disability projects.
I think it's 1 in 10 are disabled. That's about 2 million out of a 20 million population. As poverty causes disability, and the poorer people are, the more likely they are to be disabled. So there's all the sorts of disabilities that you would get normally, but on top of that there are diseases of poverty that cause disability, and also the after effects of the Civil War, where people have lost limbs, for example. But the real scourge on top of all that at the moment is the issue of HIV. In Mozambique as a whole, I think it's 16% of adults have got HIV, but in Beira it's 23%. And that's because Beira is at a crossroad, lots of people coming and going, and so the prevalence rates are higher than average. And that also has an impact on disability in a big way. But we've been able to develop a series of projects with the help of Bristol-based organisations like the Brandon Trust, and we're very grateful for their support, to help the emergence of an organisation of families of disabled children. And the change in that organisation as a result of Brandon funding has been huge, and we're delighted to see that progress is possible in short time periods. The life that disabled people have in Beira is extremely difficult, lots and lots of issues, and there's lots more that we could be doing if we found the resources to do.
We sang with Clifton High School Junior Chamber Choir today. They sang an African welcome song and a song called Power in Me, which really suited the event, because I think the children really enjoyed themselves.
And have any of the children been to Mozambique?
No, they haven't. So we've been learning about it at school, because our school has a link with the 1st of May school in Beira. They do learn about Beira in particular. But I believe we have a diplomat visiting school this afternoon, so they'll speak to her as well.
Hello. Can you tell us about the song you sang today?
Well, we sang a welcome song, and we also sang a Power in Me song about having power about yourself and being able to do what you want. And yes, been practicing them for some time.
Yeah, it was quite cool. Yeah, it's fun.
That was definitely an experience of a lifetime.
It was just the best experience ever, and I liked singing to everyone. Yeah.
I like the way the Mozambican people and the British people can get together.
I find that Mozambique's a really nice country, and it's like a really nice place, as it's like got loads of like nice features to it.
My name is Hilda Trigo Revus. I'm from Mozambique High Commission, and I'm here representing my High Commissioner.
And today is African Liberation Day.
It's African Liberation Day. It's a very good coincidence. Celebrate the link with Bristol and Beira, and celebrating the African Day. You know, the liberation of Africa was grateful for all Africans. And the friendship between people from Bristol and Beira is a result of that liberation also.
That was Anthea Page talking about the Bristol-Beira link. Thank you, Anthea, for that feature.
Coming up next, we have a feature by Tony Gosling. It's part two of a feature about the Battle of the Beanfield.
I'm Andy Worthington. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, author, filmmaker.
I think if you go back to that time, a lot of people thought that the convoys were an interesting, colourful addition to ordinary life. There are different sides of it. I mean, there were elements of it which were obviously deliberately contentious and designed to provoke a response from the establishment, you know, which clearly is what happened. But this is a modern version of a problem that nomadic peoples have had for a very long time. You know, as we saw last year with Dale Farm, there is an approach that settled people have to nomadic people, which is pretty unacceptable, but the settled people don't seem to regard it as such. They seem to think that it's acceptable to demonize this other when the other is people who don't have the same notions about where they live and how they live.
I mean, it does also maybe have some kind of resonance with the whole sort of traditional gypsy lifestyle and traditional hatred by certain political factions of that gypsy lifestyle. I mean, you know, obviously illustrated by the fascists in Germany and Hitler's treatment of the gypsies alongside the Jews in the 30s.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is part of the narrative that was going on.
Is there any real connection, do you think, between those sort of traditional nomadic people in history and what was going on in the 60s and 70s?
I mean, I think people adopted it. So I don't think necessarily that gypsies always looked favourably on the new gypsies, on what the travellers were doing. But I think that was their inspiration. And I think it's interesting when people challenge the norms and challenge the status quo in that way. And personally, I always think there should be a bit more leeway given for that kind of alternative, but there very infrequently is, you know.
Yeah, the funny thing is that, I mean, I noticed this driving around Gloucestershire and Wiltshire, is that most of the main A roads and B roads have got these wide verges, you know, regularly right the way along. This is something that's actually been designed into our old trackway system to make sure that there are places to graze horses on for travellers to stay overnight.
Yeah.
But that's now... You don't see people doing that, do you?
No. No, but it's a bit like if you look back and read or hear stories of, say, you know, the 1930s, when people were wandering around the country looking for work. I remember one time meeting this old guy who was talking about how they would get on a train and go and head somewhere and end up getting drunk in the pub and sleeping overnight and getting the train back. Everything was more flexible. I think the way we're living now, increasingly, even looking back to the 1980s, the way that we're living now is much, much more tightly regulated. There are more and more things that you aren't supposed to do. There's much more and more of a norm of how you're supposed to live. You know, those things that take place over decades, I think, you know, what interests me about modern history is how people don't necessarily realize how their attitudes have shifted from 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So when Margaret Thatcher had a certain amount of support for suppressing the way that these people were living at that point, compare it to now, it's inconceivable that people would be able to travel around as these kind of unconnected, renegade people. It just wouldn't happen at all these days.
So what do you think is the effect on youngsters of this, particularly because, I mean, it was mostly young people who were chosen that lifestyle at the time. And now we've got a situation in a way similar where we've got lots of them. I mean, we've got something like 2 million people unemployed between the ages of 18 and 24. We've got a massive sort of underclass of young people who are finding it difficult to figure out what their future is going to be in any kind of permanent way.
Yeah, well, if we look at the knock-on effects of what happened at the Beanfield, it was followed by legislation, the Public Order Act. In 1994, there was further legislation and the Criminal Justice Act. These are all pieces of legislation passed by Tory governments that were designed to suppress the free movement of people. One of the first fallouts from the suppression of the travellers and the free festival scene was restricting unlicensed gatherings of people, which it'd been kind of understood that that could happen. And that was progressively whittled away at. Obviously, the freedom to move around was hit. I mean, ironically, what happened was that then in the early 90s, there was the anti-roads movement where people occupied fixed places where roads were planned. You can almost see that the sequence was, okay, well, if we're not allowed to move around freely, then we'll settle in one place. And I think the line that you could probably draw from there to here is that that's essentially what the Occupy movement did, was to challenge the ownership of spaces and places. At the same time, the anti-roads movement was happening, probably the Reclaim the Streets movement is something that has a very direct influence on the Occupy movement as well, where people were taking over streets, shutting them down to traffic, holding street parties or holding events, just retaking back public spaces and asking questions about it. So I think it's hugely important. I think those issues of what do you do when a large number of young people don't have work and there isn't any work on the horizon, what are people going to do? And I think for people to start challenging the assumption that there isn't anything, or what's happened with the Occupy movement is some very valid questions being asked again, when it seemed that for some time there was this great illusion of money-making and wealth going on, as though those questions weren't worth asking.
The Public Order Act you mentioned, that's one aspect of the fallout from the Battle of the Beanfield. What did that mean, and what other fallout was there?
Well, it restricted the number of vehicles that were allowed to gather in one place, and that was even further restricted by the Criminal Justice Act. But the situation that we ended up with, pretty much when Tony Blair came into office, and he was an extremely authoritarian presence in British politics. But, you know, what he inherited was a situation whereby 12 people at that point constitute an illegal gathering? I mean, that's basically, the distance that had been travelled from 1984, when there were tens of thousands of people at the last Stonehenge Free Festival, to the situation under Major with the Criminal Justice Act, when 12 people in a place could be illegal. That's how far things had moved. And then, when you have Tony Blair with his authoritarian impulses, and then you have 9/11 and the hysteria of the war on terror and the assault on civil liberties, I think it's easy to see how we've ended up with, what rights do we have now?
Tell us about the Stonehenge and the free festivals, because many people would say, well, actually now English Nature organised quite a nice little festival at Stonehenge, so what have we lost?
Well, it's a good question, really. What were all those years of exclusion about? And from 1985 until 2000, it was like a war zone at Stonehenge every year. I mean, there was an exclusion zone to prevent anyone getting in, which was kind of insane. I mean, I remember a few years ago seeing a film of two Japanese tourists just looking shocked and bewildered as a policeman was truncheoning some young kid who was trying to get into Stonehenge on the solstice. This exclusion zone went on for 13 or 14 years until, through this process of a legal challenge, essentially, the House of Lords said, your exclusion zone is illegal. The challenge had arisen because some people had been protesting peacefully on the verge of the road and had been arrested. And the Lords said, well, you can't stop people protesting peacefully about things that they think that that's the only way that they can seek redress for a grievance. A great ruling. And it led to the dismantling of this exclusion zone, so that what has happened since 2000 is that there is now a free party at Stonehenge, in the Stones. And the irony is that, in the days of the Free Festival, very few people actually went to the Stones. Most people stayed on the other side of the road having their festival. So arguably what they've ended up with is something worse than what they ever intended to have in the first place. It's kind of bizarre the way it's panned out over the years.
Just tell us about the flavour of these old Stonehenge free festivals. What was the big attraction?
They were anarchic. They were just a total free-for-all. Absolutely not health and safety. I mean, that's one of the interesting things, is it's before the concept of health and safety even really existed. There was a lot of drug taking, there was a lot of music making, there was a lot of hanging out and just meeting all kinds of different people. Considering how many people were there, I think that the amount of damage that was done to anything was really very minimal, which is not really what's generally portrayed when the establishment talks about how terrible these huge anarchic gatherings were. And we're actually close to the 20th anniversary of the last of the huge spontaneous gatherings, which was Castle Morton in Gloucestershire in 1992, which again was the same. Tens of thousands of people gathering on the May Day bank holiday weekend for this crazy rave. I remember that event being extraordinary for the way that people who weren't normally meeting were getting together. It really brought together all the different subcultures. Suddenly we're all together and people were talking to each other and seeing people that they hadn't seen before, and
I wonder whether people were at these events and organising these events were actually almost learning, and a new kind of culture of self-organisation was emerging, which was, I can imagine, certainly a Conservative government of its day would have seen as quite a threat.
I think that's the case, yeah. And I think that the problem we have now is that every government, whoever they are, would see it as a threat. To bring it back up to date, you know, now we've got the Occupy movement. We've got a lot of people asking a lot of questions about why the current economic situation, why the whole setup has failed, asking very valid questions. What are they going to be allowed to do to express their dissatisfaction, to try and come up with creative new ways of dealing with things? Will they be allowed to, or will they find doors constantly shut on them? You can't occupy this space, you can't have that building, you can't do this, you can't do that. I think those questions were things that were being asked in the past when these big gatherings took place. I think the loss of them is quite sad, really.
Thanks to Soda Gosling once again for that feature, and that was part two of the feature on the Battle of the Beanfield.
It's 1 week since the Jubilee celebrations, but many people will be recalling the pomp and splendour of the Queen's coronation. In our next feature, we hear about retro food, discovering the lost joys of Le Blancmange.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and I suppose I'm a sort of food consultant. I devise recipes, I help organise food festivals, I run cooking courses here in Moreton Hampstead in Devon, and at a lovely organic farm called Ockham Farm near Paignton. But Blancmange, there's a real feeling in the country. I mean, I keep being asked to do retro cooking demos. Retro food, I suppose it's times of austerity. There's a bit of nostalgia because of the 60 years of the Queen's reign. And I started to make blancmange again. Now, blancmange was in the sort of 50s, 60s, and even into the early 70s, blancmange or shape was certainly part of my childhood. And they were wobbly and usually pink or maybe chocolate. And they are a really basic mix. Nowadays, people hardly ever eat blancmange, but it's very, very simple pudding. I think it was devised. Certainly we ate it in the 50s and 60s because to try and get milk down children, because to make the average blancmange, you need about a pint of milk, you need some corn flour, you need some sugar, and you need some flavouring. So it could be coffee flavouring or chocolate, use cocoa, or it could be, you can buy in supermarkets now, little fruit flavourings. You can buy orange or lemon or strawberry. If you want to, add a little touch of pink if you're making strawberry blancmange. But they're curiously satisfying blancmange. They've got this lovely kind of wobble to them. And I was on doing an interview the other day with a belly dancer. And it was there they were. We had this lovely big pink wobbly blancmange. And there was the belly dancer with all her wobbly bits. And it was really fun. But what people don't realise is that blancmange has a very, very ancient history. It goes back to the 14th century when the first reference to blancmange was in an ancient cookery book. And blancmange then, if you translate it literally from the French, because of course the French invented it, it means white food. And the first ever blancmange was made with shredded capon and almond milk. And it was probably thickened with some sort of form of seaweed, because the Irish make shape and they use carrageen moss or agar-agar, which is a seaweed product. In this country, we tended to, as I say, modern-day blancmanges are thickened and they get that corn flour gives it that sort of wobbly texture. But back in the 14th century, it was definitely a sweet and savoury dish combined. And then over the years, it has transmogrified into this rather bland but extremely comforting, lovely, wobbly dessert. And I can remember we used to, do you know, you see sometimes in sort of flea markets and things, you see these really detailed old jelly moulds and blancmange moulds. And these very, very ornate moulds would have been filled with a blancmange mixture and would have turned up on smart tables in Georgian and Victorian times. And then blancmanges were very much a feature of street parties, particularly at the coronation. You'd have seen blancmanges of every colour, and they'd have been covered with hundreds and thousands. And they would have been the dessert of choice.
Blancmange and belly dancers, which leads us on to our book about Damascus and the Middle East.
Indeed, Malcolm Grieve reads another chapter from The Travels of Lady Hester Stanhope from the book by Virginia Childs.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, by Virginia Childs. Winter in Hamar was dismal. After a fine start, the weather degenerated into the worst that had ever been known there. First it snowed heavily, and then it began to rain. It rained continuously for weeks, and so hard that the whole town was swamped. Houses fell down under the weight of water, killing their occupants, whilst others were drowned. It was impossible to travel from one area to another. The river Barada broke its banks and water rose up out of the wells. Conditions were appalling. Hester and Michael were cooped up with the rest of the party in a house that belonged to a powerful Delibacher called Mullah Ismail. Hester liked him very much. "He's a very jolly Turk," she wrote, "and has four wives here and, I believe, 50 women, so many that I cannot count them. They are all very good to me and less shut up than any women I ever saw in this country." Many pashas, jealous of Ismail's power, had tried to cut off his head. But none had succeeded, because apart from his influence, he was very popular with the desert Arabs, and had been able to take refuge with them twice. For this kindness, he fed every Arab who came into Hamar. Unfortunately for Hester, Ismail's house, though grand, was no better equipped than the rest to keep out the rain. "Every room is a pool," she said. It was very trying. The party had changed since Damascus. The dragoman who had been so frightened by Lady Hester's behaviour had been replaced by a man from Aleppo, Monsieur Baudin. He proved so invaluable that when he fell badly from his horse one day and had to take to his bed, the whole household became completely disorganised. Mr. Barker was still with them, although at this stage Hester did not like him. Later they were to become friends, but he had blotted his copybook with her before they had even met when he tried to interfere with her plans for Palmyra, and she had not yet forgiven him. He had still not quite recovered from the recurring fever he had contracted on the way from Aleppo, but Lady Hester had no time for what she saw as hypochondria. "He was a very troublesome patient," she declared, saying that his fever was still there only because he had fixed a certain term for its duration. He recovered as fast as he was probably able, and departed for Aleppo, no doubt thankful to leave behind both the appalling weather and Hester's disapproval. Mr. Barker was not the only one to fall ill. The dreadful conditions led to general illness throughout the retinue of servants, and poor Mrs. Fry developed pleurisy. She was very ill for a while, and the one person who could have speeded her recovery was not there. Dr. Merriam was in the desert, tending Sheikh Mahanar, who was suffering from a chronic illness. Merriam had been thrilled to be sent for by the great Arab chief, and had made his preparations quickly, having been assured by Hester that it would be safe to go. She advised him to dress as poorly as he could so as not to excite the cupidity of the Bedouin. Not relishing the prospect of being set upon and robbed in the desert, the doctor agreed heartily and went out to buy some rough clothes. 2 very coarse cotton shirts with long sleeves tapering to a point, a pair of cotton drawers which are to serve as breeches, and 2 tanned sheepskin pelisses, 1 short and 1 long. This modest wardrobe was colourfully completed with a red skull cap, a green and orange keffiyeh, or scarf, and rather jollily, a pair of uncouth red boots. On January 2nd, 1813, Merriam set off through the floods in excellent spirits with Hassan, an Arab guide, and an interpreter called Monsieur Lascari. They were well mounted on stallions and each carried a bag of provisions. After travelling for 2 hours, they entered the edge of the desert. "That name does not imply always a sandy barrenness," Merriam wrote. but rather the absence of towns and villages and the want of water and cultivation. This first part of desert was a country of hills and plains, covered with flowers in the spring, but burnt up with heat by the autumn. Now, in midwinter, it was a bleak and barren-looking place. They passed the ruins of castles and empty villages, saw immense flights of birds and the occasional small herd of antelope. As they zigzagged deeper into the desert, looking for Machanar and his tribe, the smooth plains became gravelled and rocky, and the hills gave way to craggy mountains. It took them several days to find Machanar, and they came across various small Bedouin tribes on the way, with whom they spent the nights. On each occasion they were treated with civility and respect, especially when they let it be known that they were Lady Hester's friends. There was plenty of opportunity for Merian to observe the customs of these nomadic people. He enjoyed the ceremonious making and drinking of coffee, and marvelled at the sight and sounds of the returning herds of camels, goat and sheep at sunset. The musical call of the herdsmen joined with the bleating and lowing of such vast numbers of animals, covering a circle of a league, formed a pastoral scene that can nowhere be witnessed but with the Arabs. He watched the women cooking the evening meal of mutton, rice and flat, round cakes of bread, and was appalled in his English way by the lack of hygiene and manners. It cannot be denied that they approach nearer to beasts in the manner of eating than any other people, he observed primly. They continued the search for Machanar, and finally, on about the fourth day, found him on a high plain in a small range of mountains. Merian was greeted by Nassar, Machanar's son, with kisses on each cheek and taken into the old chief's tent. Merian travelled with Machanar and his tribes for 11 days, but despite the chief's unshakable belief in the powers of Western medicines, he was unable to cure his illness. Realising that a full cure was impossible, Merian prepared to take his leave of the old man, but whenever he mentioned his plans, Machanar grew out of humour and demanded that first he be cured. When Nassar and his brothers then began, half-jokingly, to demand gifts for Merian, he started to feel quite alarmed. He was only finally allowed to leave after he invoked Lady Hester's name, saying that she would be most displeased if she had heard he had been detained against his will.
Just before we go over to Jeff for the What's On guide, we're going to meet up with the producer of Moriah Monday and The Midas Box, a film being made in Bristol and Bath, adapted from the book by G.P. Taylor. Spring Awakening star Aneurin Barnard has the lead role with Sam Neill as the baddie Luger.
Peter Bevan, I'm one of the producers of Moriah Monday, The Midas Box.
Can you tell us what production you're doing?
Well, it's called Moriah Monday, The Midas Box. It's a family adventure action movie set in the UK. It's almost an alternative Victoriana England setting, a bit like Golden Compass, a bit like as if Tim Burton had done Harry Potter. And it's about this young boy called Moriah Monday who goes to find his family who've been kidnapped by this nefarious character called Otto Luger. And this scene we're filming here today is actually a London scene outside a high-class London hotel. And it's the scene where Moriah, who's the title character, says goodbye to his parents outside the hotel.
So why did you choose Bristol?
Because of the locations, because of the good crew base that there are here. And we're working at the Bottle Yard Studios, which is new studios just on the outskirts of Bristol. But if you look at the architecture of the Bristol Marriott here, we're shooting in Bath as well. There's a good combination of facilities and great kind of period, unique locations which have been untouched by modern life that are great for the period and great for our production requirements.
So when the film's finished, where will you be showing it?
It's a theatrical movie. It'll be shown worldwide, and it's going to be delivered in spring of 2013 for release towards the winter of 2013.
And do you have a website?
If you check out www.moriahmundy.com, or look up our Facebook page or our Twitter page. We're doing regular updates about the production there.
Reporter Anthea Page was at the film shoot outside the Marriott Hotel in Bristol earlier this week. Yes, it's the moment for this week's What's On guide.
Hello. Well, it's myself, John, but this is written by Jeff, so thank you to him. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect, starting with Thursday, the 14th of June. Dr. Feelgood will be performing with support from Phoenix 26 at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance, and the doors open at 7:30pm. On Friday the 15th of June, Kevin Dempsey and Rosie Carson will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, which is up on the right-hand side in a little alleyway that's easy to miss. Tickets are £10 each and are available from Ash Keys Music, and the doors open at 7:30pm. On to the Song of the Week, and Jeff has chosen Casablanca. This five-piece rock group formed in Sweden, and they've recently released their debut album called Apocalyptic Youth, and this is a track from that album called Downtown. That was Casablanca with Downtown from their album Apocalyptic Youth. For more information, you can check out their band page on Facebook and also by searching for them on your chosen search engine. Moving on to Saturday the 16th of June, the ultimate tribute to Guns N' Roses, Guns or Roses, will be performing their debut gig in Bristol with support from Priest Unleashed and Thankless Task at the Reckless Engineer, Templegate, Bristol. Tickets are £10 each, either from the venue or Bristol Ticket Shop, and doors open at 8pm. Finally, on Sunday the 17th of June, The Clunks will be performing with support from Subversive Fire, Disruptive Influence and The Murder Scene at the Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 8pm. Now that's all from Jeff and from me pretending to be Jeff. Take care and goodbye.
That's all from Dialect this week. Features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grieve read an excerpt from Lady Hester's Travels from the book by Virginia Child. Jeff Sparks wasn't in the studio today, but we did have his What's On Guide. Studio engineer was Lee Simpson, and the producer was Anthea Page. I'm Ian Hodgkinson.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
And it's goodbye from me until next week. Goodbye.
Sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus as we offer a silent prayer for success in tomorrow's onslaught.
Major, how I'll miss you. God, the prospects for a successful attack are now ideal. I place myself in your hands.